Reich? Okay. What was it that attracted you to the work of Wilhelm Reich?
Well, I first read about him when I was 17 years old and found that his work concorded with many of my interests of that time, interests, concerns, problems, such as his great interest in sexuality, his interest in blocks to sexual expression, his concern with political questions. I was a ardent radical in those days, and his connection of economic suppression with sexual suppression greatly intrigued me. And his whole theory of something deeper beneath the surface of things, deeper life, which is a theme, of course, of literature, which I was also very interested in.
Well, as a student, you sought him out and actually had a meeting with him.
Right.
What was that meeting like?
Well, it was thoroughly remarkable. I was impressed. I am impressed in retrospect how many of the themes of my association with him were sort of imprinted or laid down or brought up at that time. First of all, I was impressed that I could see him at all and relatively easily because I was about as unknown as a person could be, and I thought he was very famous, very busy. I had heard about him through my mother, and he knew my mother slightly, but she was also no dignitary of any kind. Just a layperson who was interested in his work from her own point of view. So I was surprised that I could arrange the meeting very easily. I went out there in a state of great excitement and apprehension because already before meeting him, I felt strongly I wanted to work with him, study with him, be in this field. My second surprise was that he lived in Forest Hills in a very ordinary house, not so different than the house I lived in Brookline. I expected it was something, again, very special. The third surprise was his very great simplicity of manner. And when I apologized to him for being a half hour late because I got so disoriented on the subway, I got lost and had to take a taxi at the last minute. And he asked me how I got there. I said, by taxi. He said, no, I don't mean how did you get here literally, but how did you find out about me? And when I told him that I'd found out about him through my mother, his face fell with disappointment because he had hoped that I had heard about him from some professor at the University of Chicago who had said you ought to, you know, read or study or get to know this man, which I had not heard from any professor, nor was I likely to have, since his work was not very known in America, and what was known in terms of his recent work was generally condemned, out of hand, out of sight. So he was disappointed in that, but that was a very key theme for Reich, and it wasn't just narcissistic. It was also his fascination with the spread of his work, at who was going to pick it up and for what reason and toward what ends. He was never mechanical, like how many books were sold, but who was buying them and what were they doing with them.
You wrote that on your first meeting he asked you, are you healthy? And,
yeah.
And what did he mean by that?
Well, he meant something very specific. He meant orgastically potent, which was his definition of health, which we can get to historically at another time, but which I had already read about in his book, The Function of the Orgasm, which was published in 1942. And his belief was that the person who was psychically healthy was also sexually healthy or orgastically potent. And he meant by that something very different than being able to have sexual intercourse. Be potent in the usual sense of the term.
Had you prepared yourself for that type of question?
No, no. First of all, I didn't know much about sex at all, let alone about orgastic potency, being rather uninhibited at the time. And I didn't think that the conversation would be at that level. I thought that was a more therapeutic question if it were going to be asked at all. So I was a little startled, but at least had the wit to say I don't know, which was a frank answer. I didn't know what I was. And he then dropped the question, dropped the issue, which I thought was very thoughtful of him, didn't pursue it in any clinical sense.
You also wrote that one of your attractions to the work of Wilhelm Reich had to do with your mother's illness.
Yeah.
And what was that relationship?
Well, it's a complex relationship. My mother was very interested in new ideas, apart from her illness, before she was ill and after she was ill in the psychiatric sense, or the psychotic sense. So she was very interested in people like Freud and Havelock Ellis and Bertrand Russell and A.S. Neal, long before she heard about Reich. When she had a psychotic breakdown when I was about five, she had a whole hallucination about the end of the world coming, which often happens in schizophrenia, about the end of the world coming through a great disaster and a new world being created. All of this is fairly common to this kind of illness. But what was not common was her vision of the new world, which consisted of some kind of emotional freedom and communism. It was a kind of blend of Freud and Marx and a kind of potpourri of all of that, plus a very specific experiment that she thought would be conducted on the orgasm, which would isolate a chemical in the blood at the acme of orgastic experience. That chemical would then be sort of put in a test tube, and one would take it either orally or through injection, and one would gain eternal life from that bottleization. So she was always searching for somebody who was studying the orgasm so they would do her experiment of isolating this chemical. And that, finally, Eric Lindemann, actually a well-known psychiatrist in Boston, told her about Reich, and that's how she found out about him. And she told him this experiment, and he didn't think too much of it as an experiment per se, but he was interested in her way of thinking, which was what he would call schizoid, which can penetrate the surface of things. But on the one hand, he's like R.D. Lang in a certain liking of the schizoid mind, of the schizophrenic capacity to penetrate the surface. But he was always very skeptical of my mother, and rightly so, as a mystic, as somebody who could sense important things, but who couldn't develop them, couldn't work with them, couldn't do anything practical with them. And that was very true of her. She couldn't. And it often used these ideas very destructively as a kind of propaganda or ideology, and not living them. Or living the opposite of them very often.
I guess we're going to be spending a lot of time during the next while talking about orgone theory, which was probably the largest contribution that Wilhelm Reich made. Can you give a brief overview of the orgone energy theory is and what the orgone accumulator was?
That's a big question. I don't like to do it, isolate the orgone. Let me just give you a brief 2-minute summary of his work. One of the things he was fascinated by was the flow of energy in the body, the flow of sexuality, sexual energy in particular, emotional energy in general, and sexual energy in particular. In sexual intercourse, for example, all the mechanical processes could occur, say in the male erection, ejaculation, with very little pleasure being experienced. So he was interested in what had to flow for pleasure to be felt. And his first working assumption was libidinal energy based on Freud. There's a libido, and if that's blocked or fixated, it doesn't flow freely, and pleasure is not perceived. And he was then interested in releasing that energy through his character analysis, working on defenses, character defenses, where this energy would be bottled up, and later on muscular rigidities, which we may get into, where it's also bottled up. So he worked very hard on freeing the flow of energy and feeling in the body, which ultimately is experienced as a pleasurable flow of feeling, and not right away by any means. Then he went into experimental measures of this flow of the energy in the body and claimed that he could measure the sensation of pleasure in the body through an oscillographic reading. Well, I don't have to go into the technical details. We'd be here all night, plus I don't know them too well. One of the problems of Reich is that to evaluate all his work, you've got to be a lot of different things, some of which I'm not. Through a path too complicated to go into, he began to feel that the same energy as he was studying in the body also flowed in the atmosphere. And we know that in a kind of intuitive way, that we respond to weather. On a clear, dry day, we feel more alive. The day feels more alive. There's a sparkle in the atmosphere. There hasn't been for some weeks now, at least in my experience of it, in a great deal of humidity or pollution or no wind, no freshness. So he began to study this sparkle in the atmosphere as he had earlier studied the absence of sparkle or bringing about the sparkle in the human body. Again, through rather complex experiments, Reich was not some Indian philosopher who dreamt up these things. He was constantly trying to measure them, study them, observe them. He was very, very much a scientist in my view. He began to, he devised a device which consisted ridiculously simply of organic material like, say, a rug, which collects this spark, and we know we get a spark from a rug on a dry, clear day or from nylon, and he had metal to contain this energy, reflect it, and contain it, and that's all it is. The accumulator is simply Celotex, or organic material, and inorganic material. Organic on the outside, inorganic on the inside, and it can be multiple layers. And he had measures, a temperature that was greater. This generated heat when, by classical laws, it should not. It had a slower electroscopic discharge, and that people who used this regularly developed a stronger energy field. That did not make them sexually healthy, as it was often claimed. It just gave more energy. If the energy is disturbed, they'd have more energy for disturbance. But many people suffer from lack of energy, weakness, depression, fatigue, tired feelings, and the accumulator helped that. We'll get back to this, but you go ahead.
So the accumulator was literally some type, like a box which would accumulate or focus the type of orgone energy that he was concerned about.
And that interacted with the energy of the person sitting in it. It wasn't a mechanic. A person with low energy might sit months before they felt any. People with a stronger energy would feel things much more quickly.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Myron Sheriff, who is the author of Fury on Earth, a biography of Wilhelm Reich. And my guest has had studied and worked with Wilhelm Reich for about 10 years, and that is in part the basis of the biography which he's written, which has just been published by St. Martin's Press. How would you place Wilhelm Reich's early work on sexuality in the context of the prevailing beliefs of the day, keeping in mind that Freud had his own beliefs which had preceded this?
Let me just connect it with Freud, because Freud is the dominant figure in the 20s, not Reich. In his early work, Freud put a good deal of emphasis on a type of neuroses which he called actual neuroses, which involved the direct blocking up of sexual energy through certain sexual practices like coitus interruptus or long periods of abstinence. This could create an anxiety neurosis or an actual neurosis, almost independent of any psychoneurosis, any earlier history of neurotic problems. He advised not psychoanalysis for these people, but sexual counseling. That was one very important idea that Reich picked up, that is, direct blockage of sexual energy through, Reich extended it not only to abstinence, a coitus interruptus, but to inadequate sexual release. Freud also had other more better-known ideas about the fixation of libido in pregenital stages, oral, anal, phallic, and a lack of development to the genital stage. By the genital stage, he didn't mean what Reich meant by genitality, like the capacity for orgastic potency. He meant that you're able to relate and have sexual relations with the opposite sex without huge disorders like impotence, frigidity, or splits between Madonnas and whores in the man. But there was a definite emphasis on that progression, and Reich was interested in both. And that idea was very current in the 1920s when Reich started. Actual neuroses wasn't so emphasized anymore because Freud lost interest in that particular issue. And Freud was interested in all the obstacles to the deeper material coming out, resistances and defenses and all that stuff. So Reich hooked on to that problem of freeing the energy from prelibidinal fixations through a more thorough analysis of the blocks to it, the obstacles, the defenses, resistances, all of which were known in psychoanalytic thought. And up till this point, some of Reich's emphasis were get out negative feelings, negative transference. It can often be very concealed. Psychoanalysts knew about negative transference, but they, by and large, welcomed this elaboration of its subtlety, its subtle expressions. He also said, don't go into deeper unconscious material till you've analyzed resistances, and not just obvious ones, but character traits like arrogance or evasiveness that got in the way of people talking about important things with emotion. He focused on that, also an early Freudian idea, that emotion had to be there with the memories. And Reich said these character defenses block that emotion, so don't interpret deep material. Freud took some objection to that idea, as did some analysts. Other analysts welcomed it more. All this was not terribly controversial, though Reich was sufficiently original and sufficiently aggressive as a young man to provoke quite a bit of controversy even before he got really controversial. When he got really controversial was what you brought up, started with in the beginning, was genitality. And by that he didn't mean just reaching the genital stage, but having a satisfactory sexual experience. At first he didn't define that too clearly, and the analyst said, well, we got plenty of patients who are sexual as the Dickens. This argument still goes on, and they got all kinds of neurotic symptoms, so you must be wrong. And Reich, in his typical way, said, well, he had to admit to himself, because he didn't like to admit he was wrong, that he had some patients who fitted this category, particularly men, who seemed pretty, you know, potent, and yet were very disturbed. But he went back to the drawing board and said, aha, they look potent, but they're really not potent. It's a local genital release, and then it was really his second paper on genitality. He began to expand. What did he mean by genitality? He meant this full release, full surrender, a lapse in consciousness right at the moment of acme, a total body experience of intercourse, not just a genital experience. The analyst came back and said, we have plenty of patients with complete genital experience, and they're sick as hell. But they didn't ever say, we have patients who report this, 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 just like your description, and they're sick as hell. There may be such patients. I don't know. I haven't seen them. But there may be. The Reichians keep saying it can't be. If they're sick in other ways, then they're sick genitally. But that's not evidence. That's dogma. At any rate, I feel Reich's argument about orgasmic potency is terribly important and is never convincingly argued. The real argument is not that there are a lot of people who are orgastically potent but neurotic. My belief is the real argument is, where are these orgastically potent people? I haven't seen them, including many people who have been through Reichian therapy. That doesn't mean they don't exist. You know, you might discover that everybody lacks some vitamin. They may lack it. It may be important, even though nobody's got it.
Well, let me
go ahead.
Make sure that I understand. What you're saying is you see the real some of the real significance of Reich's work as a way of finding the way to become orgastically potent.
That's
in
right.
The Reichian sense.
It's like if somebody described democratic socialism, you know, in which you had a lot of equality and also a lot of democracy. I could say, yeah, that's an important direction. Let's try to get there. But I can't find that anywhere. I might not be able to find that anywhere in the world existing. Maybe all the socialist places don't have democracy. Maybe all the places that have democracy don't have. But it could still be a regulative principle. It could be worth looking for. And I feel Reich's concept led him to find all sorts of things by this emphasis on orgastic potency, and that it's a direction toward which we're moving. But it's an illusion to think that you go through Reichian therapy and become orgastically potent, because by and large you don't. You may become freer and have a better sexual life and have more energy and less conflict, but you don't necessarily become what he insisted was the goal of therapy, because he didn't want to give this up, but which he knew very few people achieved. So there's a dichotomy there. Do you understand what I mean?
Just to clarify, what would be the orgasmically potent person?
I tried to describe that earlier. This completes. You mean in sex or in general?
No, in general. I mean, what are the social and emotional implications of that?
Well, it's a person who is life positive, whose emotions are relatively free, who can love, who can surrender, who can give himself over to his work with excitement and not out of compulsive duty, who can have monogamous relationships but not necessarily rigidly monogamous or guilt-ridden or be with one partner all their life, but neither a Don Juan. A person who is in contact with himself in the world and gets intrinsic satisfaction out of things rather than work for the money or the prestige. He works because he enjoys working. Because the armor that's in the way of orgastically potent is in the way of every impulse that's a full, complete one. That's stated ideally, because there are people who have armor, you know, I don't know, Gandhi or Thoreau, who do enormous amounts of work, and I think with a lot of intrinsic satisfaction.
I guess the reason I'm a little confused is that I think I understand what you mean by orgastically potent, and those individuals, I would think, they're probably not the average individual, but don't you think they exist?
Which one? Who are orgastically potent? Yes, but I just haven't seen many of them. I think they exist. And, you know, my sample is biased because I see a lot of people who are either patients or therapists, and that's a skewed sample of people who are sort of interested in problems because they've got problems. There may be people out there who, and I think there are, who don't talk about orgastic potency but live it. I just haven't met too many. And I think Reich overestimated the number. He thought there were a lot, but not a lot, but a sizable number. But evidence requires find them, you know, find out about them. Are they orgastically potent? Are they relatively free of neurotic problems? We need to find them if they exist. Go ahead.
Why did he move to Berlin? What were the forces that...
Well, then I have to get... Reich's life is so full, it's incredible. We could spend an hour on each question you ask. He moved to Berlin because in 1927 he got heavily involved in social questions. There was a huge struggle between the right and the left. People were marching in the streets. People were being shot. And he joined that social struggle against fascism, really, and joined it on the side of the left, the socialists and the communists, which was pretty much the choices because the middle ground wasn't very strong. And at that time he was a Marxist, too. He was attracted to the communist interpretation of history. Russia was relatively progressive in the 20s, particularly in the sexual realms. So Reich argued, there are too many neurotic people to treat them. We got to prevent neuroses. How do you prevent neuroses? Well, children and adolescents have to be supported in their emotional and sexual life. They have to have the economic means to be able to have a sexual life. You need housing, and you can't be dying of starvation and be sexually healthy. So he joined the political struggle and tried to do that from his angle, the emotional sexual angle, because he said people are bored to death with purely economic analysis, and he would talk about abortion, birth control, the relationship of this to the political parties, which parties supported it, which didn't, not unlike some of the issues that are coming up today.
Well, there was a group called the German Association for Proletarian Sex Politics.
Yeah.
What was their agenda, and what was Reich's connection with them?
Well, he started it, so his connection was very strong. What he tried to do was link. He was always linking. There were sex reform groups in Berlin. He moved to Berlin because it was just much more active. There were many more communists. There were more analysts. Vienna was rather small. Plus, Hitler was coming. You know, it looked like the social battle was going to be fought in Germany. And he had a way of getting where he needed to be, and he needed to be in Berlin then, where there were many more socially oriented analysts, Marxist-oriented analysts, like Erich Fromm and Otto Fenichel. So he goes there. There are also sex reform groups who want to change laws about sexuality, against homosexuality, against birth control. They would like have birth control for fiancé and married people. I mean, that was about as radical as they would get. Well, Reich wanted to unite them with the Marxist movement, plus push them to the left on sexual questions. Birth control for anybody who wanted it, more like today. But at that time, that was very bold, because even to have it for engaged couples or abortion for married people was heretical in the legal and moral senses. But he went to Berlin and fought very actively in the Communist Party for his concerns for what he calls sex politics, politicizing personal issues, which he felt Hitler was doing in a negative way, because Hitler's ideology was full of sexuality. The Jews are sexual swine. They'll debase our beautiful blonde women. We'll have youth camps for Aryan boys and Aryan girls, and they can produce babies, but they'll be for Hitler. He combined a kind of moralistic emphasis with a kind of exciting, passionate surge of the blood for Hitler, you know?
Do you know how he tried to explain this to the people who were interested in his thinking but probably weren't quite as far along as he was?
He would explain, look, Hitler's grabbing them. We can't just dismiss him as a psychotic. Look how he's playing on these sexual feelings. We're for sexual feelings too, but not in this perverted way. And Hitler's appealing to the longing in people, but twisting it. We will appeal to the longing in people for a healthier sexual life in a rational way. We'll offer them birth control, abortion, rooms of their own. We'll give them help if we can. Of course, help was limited because there weren't that many people who could help. But still, he wanted to have briefer sexual counseling. And he was a very effective speaker and could address huge groups of people, and young people flocked to him. But the communists, from a political viewpoint, and Reich often denounced the communists, and Reich understandably so, because they turned against him and said, this is gutter politics, this is sexual swinishness and stuff. But from a political viewpoint, this was madness, because there weren't that many people who were going to affirm adolescent sexual life. They were scared of it. I mean, voters, Catholic voters, it was not good politics. It wasn't good politics for McGovern in 72 when he talked about abortion. 32 in Germany was still less good politics. So they kicked him out. Meanwhile, the analysts were mad at him because he was insisting on prevention of neuroses through affirmation of healthy genital life of children and adolescents. And he was angry at them for not being more Marxist, and he was challenging certain principles, certain more conservative therapeutic principles. So he was in trouble with everybody. And in 1933, he's kicked out of the communists, and in 1934, he's kicked out of the analysts.
Did he make, I'm sure he did actually, but how did he make a link between a society accepting Nazism and the way he saw emotional health in people and in a society? What was his explanation for the rise of Nazism at that time?
Well, his explanation of the rise of Nazism in Germany, because, you know, there are other conservative countries that didn't go Nazi, was that Hitler appealed to the mixture of a rise in sexual expectation, in sexual excitation, and a tremendous fear of it. You know, the Weimar Republic period was a very permissive period. I mean, there were very exciting things going on in the arts. The Blue Angel captures, the movie The Blue Angel captures this contradiction of a rigid professor who's all stimulated to death by Marlene Dietrich and is prepared to die for her. And but he obviously can't live with her, and he can't live without her. And this was the relationship of the German people to their impulse. They're all excited, but they can't fulfill it. Hitler's saying, I'll give you the excitement, but I'll give you the controls too, because it's all for Hitler. And follow me, and I'll tell you what to do, and the Jews are to blame, and, you know, all that stuff. So Hitler was a logical answer to this ferment, this chaos, this longing, and this fear. And he permitted them both excitement and discipline.
Was Reich Jewish?
He was born Jewish, but he never identified very much with Judaism. I mean, he would never say he wasn't a Jew, but he didn't want to be called a Jew in the sense of somebody who believed in the Jewish religion.
Did that influence his stay in Germany at all? Did he?
Oh, yes, he had to get out of there because he was a Jew, a communist, a psychoanalyst, and a well-known anti-Nazi who had been denouncing Hitler. And plus, I mean, you know, don't forget, Hitler was denouncing what he called cultural Bolshevism, which was destruction of the family, promiscuity, defloration of virginal Aryan women. And Reich was a leader of that whole movement, not in Hitler's sense of it, but he was about as, you know, antithetical to Hitler as anybody could be. But he took Hitler seriously, and I think that's to his everlasting credit. He didn't just say, he's crazy, or he's just a tool of a capitalist. You know, what's this guy saying? Why do people follow him? He took his opponents very seriously.
You're just joining me, I'm speaking with Myron Sheriff, who is the author of Fury on Earth, a biography of Wilhelm Reich, and that's published by St. Martin's Press. What turn did Reich's work take when Reich came to the United States in 1940?
Let me just, I just want to go back a little bit. Because once, to get to his therapy, his psychiatric therapy, once Reich was kicked out of the psychoanalytic organization, that was a huge personal rejection because he loved Freud and it hurt. But it was also enormously liberating because he could do certain things he couldn't do before. He could touch patients, which he hadn't done. As an analyst, you're not permitted to touch. You analyze and you talk, but you don't confuse the situation, in quotes, by touching. Reich was, by this point, very interested in how the body expressed the emotional condition, the emotional complexes. We say, for example, he's a stiff-necked person. Well, Reich said he took popular language seriously, just as he took Nazism seriously, and said maybe the person is actually stiff-necked and, you know, began to touch the neck and feel that it was, in fact, stiff. Or uptight, all the words we use today, which have quite a lot of body references, spaced out, suggest that they're eyes aren't in focus. And Reich began studying the whole way the body holds back emotions, as earlier he had studied the way the character holds them back. Arrogance holds back emotions, stiff-neckedness holds back emotions, and one of his great discoveries, holding the breath cuts feeling. If you think of yourself getting very emotional and you want to stop it, you pull your breath in, pull your chest up, tighten your chin and jaw, and, you know, look sort of fixedly, or, you know, frightenedly, and stop it. And so he began studying all those processes in a brilliant work. That was in Scandinavia. It's interesting. You think of Scandinavia in the body. Think of Germany. You think of politics. The 30. You think of Scandinavia. You think of more body emphasis. And so he did that. That was freer. And he was freer to give up his radical political interest. There was no place to go. I mean, Russia was becoming totally conservative, reactionary, anti-sexual. Hitler, no place for him with Hitler. So there was no place to go politically. He didn't want to start another political party. The Trotskyites weren't that interested in what he was doing. Plus, he was tired of radical politics. It was he put up with it a long time. So he had more time to do experimental work, which he had long been interested in, and started this. He had two things. He wanted to be more social than the analysts, more bodily than the analysts, and he wanted to be more experimental than the analysts. And he started laboratory work, measures, testing. Does this energy exist? And that takes him to the Orgone, and he pursues that in America, where he just had the Orgone accumulator, continuing his psychiatric therapy, which was quite popular with a group of people and a number of physicians. And he was a flourishing therapist in the 40s, early 40s particularly, and very talented people came to him. William Steig, Saul Bellow was in treatment with a student of his. Theodore Wolfe was a well-known psychiatrist. Ellsworth Baker had a position in New Jersey of some status. But more importantly, those were a number of sort of cultural people, like Paul Goodman got interested. It's not very well known, but the Beat poets were very interested. Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, Burroughs. That wasn't in the therapeutic mainstream, but it was sort of entering the social body politic, so to speak, in the larger sense.
What point did you start getting involved as 40, a worker with him?
47. Well, 46. I was in the Army, and I kept contact. 47. I had more contact. 48, I started translating, and I worked with him up in Maine, starting the summer of 48.
And what was the type of work that was going on in his lab?
He was doing a lot of experimental work, measuring the orgone energy with the temperature difference. He had a Geiger-Müller counter. He had vacuum tubes that soaked in the accumulator, and that he then could make luminate with a very small amount of electricity, or even with a static charge that you couldn't get if you hadn't soaked these things first in his boxes. All kinds of experimental work. I can't go into it all. He had done quite intensive work with cancer earlier, treatment of cancer mice and dissections and autopsies. And then he treated humans with the 15, about, well, it was more than, I think he had about 30 altogether, but 15 that were studied rather carefully, cancer patients, very sick by and large.
Did you ever do work yourself inside an accumulator to find out how that affected you personally?
Oh, yeah, I used it. I still use it. I've used it for 35 years, and I have not had, by and large, any specific illnesses. I can suffer from fatigue, and I find that on a good day it helps me, I believe. But this is what is in science called anecdotal evidence. If you believe in something like the accumulator, it's hard to separate out entirely. Am I feeling better because I want to feel better and because I believe I'll feel better and because Reich said I'd feel better? Or am I really feeling better for purely energetic, objective factors, like I'm accumulating an energy? And that's why experiments with mice and plants are so important, because unless you beat up the mice that aren't in the accumulator, the mice don't care whether they're in the accumulator or not. They're not saying, oh, this is a wonderful energy and isn't right great. They're just in the accumulator.
What's your experience with that now? How much time would you spend now to get the benefits of that?
Well, it varies. Usually I don't... When I first started, one of the things that convinces me about the accumulator is when I most wanted to feel it, I didn't feel it. When I began using it, I would sit there for like 2 hours. I wouldn't feel a thing. And then it gradually began to cut down. I'd get restless after an hour, then a half hour, and reached a point where I couldn't sit more than 10 or 15 minutes. Now, depending upon the weather and how low in energy I am, I can sit variable amounts.
Do you read inside again?
I read because I get bored. I'm not a good meditator.
So but it's basically the being inside the accumulator that's the trick, not really matter what you're doing inside.
No, I just find it makes the time more. I enjoy it more if I read. Otherwise, I get bored.
If somebody comes to your house or your office and wanted to sit inside the accumulator, would you let them sit in it? Do you need some type of commitment from somebody before they could try it out?
Yes. I can tell a serious interest. I'm good at that now. For example, can I use your accumulator? By and large, I say, no, not yet. But there are some very serious people. I don't want anybody with an illness. I don't, by and large, treat. I'm not a physician. In fact, this is a purely educational effort. It's not part of my treatment, just as I would lend somebody a book to read. So I would say if they're interested in the accumulator, seriously interested and want just to see for themselves? Yes, because I feel until people start using it, we're never going to find... It's still under a ban. You've got to remember that. We haven't got to the FDA, but the FDA said this was like Laetril. It's nothing. So I still feel a little... I don't want anybody saying I'm treating people with the accumulator because I'm not equipped to. And if, I think that should be done in a very serious, organized way. You don't want to, you know, this is, can be a red flag for many people.
Did the FDA ban the use of the accumulator or the prescription of the accumulator? What was the...
They banned everything, but it was against Reich. They didn't ban anybody from you. You have to bring a new injunction if you would like to try to use it. It was a, let me get to that.
We have time yet. Well, if you tell us about what the FDA said.
All right. So Reich is publishing in a journal that is read, I don't know, it couldn't have been more than 500 people, and his books maybe a couple thousand at most, about the use of the accumulator with cancer and various illness. Reich says he never claimed cures. Well, he didn't. He was cautious, but he was also claiming quite a bit. I mean, that certain cancer tumors were reduced, people got better of different illnesses, and while he kept cautioning it's no miracle, this was powerful stuff. The FDA, there was an article, that will take another hour, so I won't go into that article. The FDA's intention was called to this accumulator, and they said, who's this guy, and why do you let him sell this box of his? He was renting this box. He wasn't. His foundation was, and the money went for research. And I really know how diligent Reich was about using the money for research and the $250,000 at least he put in his own funds that he raised from private practice to support his orgone research. Nobody was giving him any grants from NIMH or the Defense Department. He did it on his own and with what support he could muster up from people around him, which he was no... blushing violet about that.
Why do you think the FDA and the courts went after him with the vengeance that they did? He was sentenced to jail for 2 years for this.
Yeah, let's get to. They went after him initially because for several reasons. First, in the 1950s, they had a budget of about $6 million, if I recall correctly. They're not going to go after some big. You can't go after some big companies with $6 million. And now they'll go after. It's changed. They'll go after some very big people. But they went after the little guy then, and we got another cancer quack, the equivalence of Laetril or the orgone box in their view, or sort of little guys that you could bring a case against without too much of a effort. I think they genuinely thought it was. I think they had their own motives. You know, they made a lot of cracks about the sex box and the sex racket and they didn't like Reich, and they hated, you know, a lot of they stood for. But I think they also thought they were doing their job. I mean, this box would sound ridiculous. And so they did some tests, which were on the large, were not very good, though a few of them were not bad. They got, you know, reputable places to test it. They weren't, I think it was an awful investigation, but you've got to give the devil his due. They did some real tests. Some of them were positive that were never even heard about, positive for Reich. But many of them were terrible because they would take somebody with terminal cancer, put him in the accumulator twice, and say he died. And Reich always said it takes quite a while, and you know he was much more cautious than their experimental condition. They had this experimental evidence. Reich didn't know what it was. All he knew was that they were asking these questions about people, about their sex lives, and he was enraged. I think he was also threatened. He was a proud man. He didn't want to go into a court and have all kinds of questions asked of him. He felt it was a scientific matter, but he never got around the question of who decides what's quackery, because he was not an anarchist. He felt genuine quacks should be prevented from functioning. But he never got around, never solved the question who decides who's an innovative, genuine scientist and who's a real quack. Only a jury can decide that because everybody else has got a vested interest in the answer.
How did you and your coworkers react to the type of stress and ridicule that the lab was getting at this time?
Oh, that was standard. That was before the FDA. That people were always making jokes about orgies. The place was called Organon, so it was orgies at Organon, orgies. But people were also friendly. It wasn't, you know, people weren't coming up with shotguns. So we lived with that. You know, that's what you lived with. I mean, there was a lot of suspicion, and there was just a lot of just ordinary behavior. The FDA thing, just to I could go very quickly. They prepared a complaint of injunction saying this is fraudulent, it doesn't exist, it's a nothing box, it collects nothing, he's offering cures, and we plead for destruction of the accumulators and no more accumulators. And they made something vague about any advertising of the books, of the accumulators should be also eliminated. Reich made the huge decision, the very fateful decision, not to go to court. He sent his books to the judge, which, I mean, can be argued on certain principle grounds, but on certain realistic grounds was crazy. I mean, because no judge is going to read books, though I think the judge should have told him, this isn't an answer, come to court. But nobody told him that. And Reich could be naive and saying, I convinced them with my books. Well, he didn't convince anybody. There was a complaint. The actual injunction was far worse than the complaint, which is unusual. Usually the prosecutor gets less than what he's seeking. Here they got more. And they ordered the destruction of not only the accumulators, but of Reich's literature, all of his literature that dealt a lot with orgone energy, and even his famous works like Character Analysis and Mass Psychology of Fashion, where in later editions he had referred in footnotes or here and there to orgone energy. Everything pertaining to orgone energy had to be blacked out. It was a real censorship thing. And allied material. Well, nobody could define what allied material was. Is that libido? And Reich wouldn't do that. And Reich defied that injunction. He sent the books out through a complicated story, which I won't go into, and the accumulators. And then they had him for contempt of injunction, and he really didn't plead innocent. I mean, he said he had done it, but he had to do it. If somebody would say, I didn't go to war because it was an unconstitutional war, so he said, I defied an unconstitutional injunction. I had to do it. Was sentenced to 2 years in jail and died. In jail.
I'm sorry.
Which was a very harsh sentence.
You're right. Yeah. I'm sorry that we only have a minute left, but in this minute, could you just tell us how you think Wilhelm Reich is represented in psychology texts today and just amongst your peers?
Well, I think it's in a period of rapid flux. The standard opinion up to fairly recently was Reich was a great contributor to character analysis, to these character defenses, negative transference that I mentioned earlier. Everything else was either wrong, like a lot of his social stuff or his sexual stuff, or it's crazy, like the orgone box. That was the standard opinion. Now, there is something that might be called creeping Reichianism. I mean, now they're talking more about muscular armor. Maybe he's onto something there. His social work is more highly regarded. But the later scientific work is still considered largely beyond the pale, even though there are many more connections between what he was interested in, like resistance to illness, and what is currently being thought of under immunological research. There's much more emphasis on the host, the resistance of the organism, not just the viruses, the invading organism.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us today on Fresh Air.